A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
We are now recording. Don't say anything incriminating.
How's your son?
Welcome back to the Front Three. It's good to have you. No Adam this week. Sorry, but we have gone stateside with two stateside journalists, I want to say. Or writers. Kristen Hennage, long-term fixture of the podcast. Good to have you.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on, Christian, as so many people call you. And then Nico. Do I call you Nick or do I call you Nico? Which one do you prefer?
Whatever floats your boat, I think.
Really? Do you not? Is Nico like a term of endearment, or is Nick like just too formal?
It depends on who you are. If you're a woman in my life, usually you call me just Nick, and usually angrily. If you're my parents or you guys, you call me Nico.
Interesting. Okay, right. He takes the less rounded name with the females, but the more rounded name, a more subtle, more nice sounding name with his family. Interesting. Have you ever had a woman call you Nico?
I'm not going to answer that question.
Fair enough. Here are some questions he will answer on the Front Three this week. Manchester City versus Lyon. Nico, there are a lot of people picking this one apart already because people were so gleeful over the fact that Man City crashed out of the Champions League in the year when everyone was going, oh, this is ideal for them to win it, blah, blah, blah. Have you had any sort of post-mortem thoughts as a fan of Pep's football and not necessarily Manchester City?
Yeah, I think, you know, I've thought about it a lot because the takes have been pretty interesting after this one.
Right.
But obviously, you know, we've heard it a million times. Even before the game, you know, the tired narrative or regurgitated narrative of Pep Guardiola overthinking the tie comes to the fore, and people, you know, like to imagine what he might do, and then the game happens, and we found the past, I don't know, 5 or 6 times that he's apparently overthought it. The reason I don't necessarily subscribe to that theory, aside, you know, maybe I have to acknowledge some degree of bias. Like you said, I'm not necessarily a fan of Manchester City in these times where we can assess our morality, but I am a fan of him as a coach and the style of football that he plays. So there is a degree of bias to the way that I think that I have to acknowledge, but I don't really think that there is like an element of overthinking, because I don't think that's the way that he chooses to approach games. He doesn't, from the press conferences I've seen and from, you know, the very matches that we are all subject to, I don't think he makes decisions based off of the magnitude or stature or occasion of the game. What we saw was, and he said this in the press conference afterwards, was that, you know, because of the nature of the way Manchester City play, high possession team that likes to play with a high line so that they have better efficacy in their pressing, they tried to, you know, cover some of those weaknesses by not necessarily being more conservative, but playing João Cancelo and Kyle Walker in a specific role that maybe it wasn't as advanced or maybe more defensively focused, because he said, you know, they're very good at attacking the channels and we didn't want to leave them in their buildup and, you know, provide a bunch of space for them out wide. So we tried to cover our weak points, and that resulted in Manchester City not playing the best on the ball for the first 15 or 25 minutes. And then, you know, Lyon scored a pretty decent or rather low expectancy chance, and the game went on from there. They played a good second half and things just didn't pan out. I understand the criticism of some of the approach, because some, as many have said, you know, but hindsight is 2020, that if they would have just lined up as they always do and focused on the things that they're good at and created a bunch of chances, you know, maybe things could have gone a different way. But I think it's not unreasonable, especially given the way that we've spoken about Pep Guardiola in the past, to imagine that, you know, the things that have been leveled as criticisms at him before is that, you know, he's idealistic and he prefers his style of football, especially in these knockout games that are down to a single game in this year's competition because of the coronavirus. You know, he prefers his style of football, and maybe that's too idealistic. So you have a coach maybe that's changing approach a little bit now to account for some of the things that his talented opponents are doing. He did it against Real Madrid and it obviously worked. So that's kind of why I don't really agree with the narrative, but I'm interested to see what you guys have to say about it.
Well, it's certainly an interesting one, isn't it, Chris? Because I think the overall, there is a narrative that's run in the press and, you know, Twitter and everywhere else after that, that Pep does seem to overthink these things. Or maybe when we're not thinking about overthinking, we're talking about overcomplicating for the players possibly, or there are changes which specifically seem to screw up a certain element of a player's game. Am I wrong in that? Or like, is it just that people are drawing these lines because they don't normally watch Man City with that level of incision?
I think to me, what it is, when we look at the idea of overthinking, I almost associate an overactive mind with Pep Guardiola anyway, whether it's the Champions League semi-final or an away trip to 18th place. I think he has always operated with that very detail-heavy approach. I think what stands out to me when it comes to these types of games, like the one against Lyon, is that, to me, looking as an outsider, it comes across slightly as a little lacking of self-confidence in what he has used up until that point. So he starts to think, well, how can we adapt to essentially remove the weaknesses that they may have identified? Whereas I think, as Nico alluded to there, if he had just gone with what he seems to do most weeks in the Premier League, thrown Foden in there, maybe David Silva, I do think they would have blitzed Lyon off the park. I think it's difficult when we try and analyse these Champions League games, because I do think the narratives or the talking points get established really quick and then hammered into the ground about, well, you know, technically Lyon aren't the seventh worst team in France and blah. I get that. I totally get that. That's not an inaccurate evaluation based on the individual talent that they have. But when I put those two teams together 10 times, I think Man City can blitz them fairly comfortably more often than not. Now, I grant that's not the most scientific evaluation, but you get the point that I'm alluding to. And I just think that for Guardiola, it needs to be, I don't know, I think it just needs to be more confidence in what he does. And I thought it was crazy to read this morning that Xavi was advocating like just throwing more money at the problem, because I don't really think that's the issue. It wasn't a lack of talent that stopped them winning. I think it was a combination of him trying to adapt to a situation that didn't really need any adaptation, that I think would have been quite confident in his original plan. And then also the fact that this Lyon side were very good. And I think actually something that I've not really seen touched on is I think they took some lessons from what Mikel Arteta did in the FA Cup semi-final.
Right, okay. So you're saying, yeah, once someone sort of works that out, it becomes very difficult for Man City to quickly counter that.
Because I think Guardiola touched on some of the reasons that he tried to adapt. I think it was to do with him being concerned about their strikers in the channels and things like that. But if you watch the first goal, Nico talked about it being low efficiency chance that you used, sorry, or low
expectancy? It's just like, didn't have a great expectancy going in.
So if I can just take away the finish for a second, or the that moment, the build up to it, the sort of, it gets played quite wide, then goes back inside, and what has happened in my opinion is that through that little interchange, they've pulled a defender out, and then gone back and straight over the top. And if you watch Arsenal's second goal in the FA Cup for Aubameyang, it's a very similar build-up. It's not identical, but it's certainly similar. And it's something actually that I've seen Guardiola use himself, where he will essentially rotate midfielders around with a view of pulling a defender, usually a fullback, towards the ball, and then using the space that's been created to expose the opposition by then ferrying a fullback in behind. So I think that's the other thing, is that he built such a robust system, Guardiola, at Man City, that there are going to be times where teams, just because of how many games they play, how many people try different ideas, that you're going to build up a pretty strong repertoire of ways to potentially test them and put them under. And you're going to lose some games. Is it disappointing for the project? Yeah. I think this is probably, in my opinion, one of the best chances they've had to win the Champions League this year because of COVID and the craziness and all of that stuff. But at the same time, I think there's a little bit more shade of grey between the two scenarios here that are being put forward.
Well, it's certainly a strange one. I guess, Nick, do you want me to give you a bit of an opportunity to reply to what Chris just said there? Because, I mean, it's not as if any style of football is completely infallible, but strangely, we seem to hold Pep Guardiola to this almost infallible level of footballing excellence because of the narrative that has been built up around him. We sort of go, well, you know, he'll win every game because he plays perfect football. So in many ways, the appearance or the reputation that precedes him doesn't necessarily help him or his teams sometimes, because his teams can also be expected to perform almost perfectly, which is obviously not always going to be the case.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we also, like you said there, sort of engage with Pep, the idea of Pep Guardiola, and maybe not sometimes, and maybe not the actuality of Pep Guardiola a lot of the time. Like I said, against Real Madrid, there was some tactical tinkering, and there was, you know, they played a 4-4-2 with Gabriel Jesus on the left, and it did well to both pin Carvajal back and also provide some fluidity in the attack when they needed it in transition. So in the same sense that we might criticize someone or Pep Guardiola in this scenario for adjusting when, or, you know, twisting when he needed to stick or whatever the phrase is, there was, you know, we didn't engage with it that way. We didn't engage with the analysis in the same way in the previous round. And I can appreciate a lot of the sentiments in the direction of, well, if Man City just, you know, lined up as they always did, then their, you know, their chance creation would have done the rest. It's not as if the game was particularly even as it stood. You know, they created a ton of chances and they conceded some, which you could say is sort of antithetical to the supposedly more solid approach that he wanted to actuate. But equally, I think that's just football. You know, he's talked about it. He's talked about this quote unquote Champions League curse himself in a lot of press conferences and said, you know, if you look at the some of the games against Chelsea when he was at Barcelona and other things, you know, he has said it himself. You know, there are games that we were the lesser team. We did not deserve to go through, and he went through. And there have been games on the other end of the spectrum where they were by far the better team. And I think this is one of those cases, and they didn't go through. So a lot of the times it is just football, but
do you think, though, that is to some extent distracting or detracting away from what the actual question here is here with Pep, that getting a team over the line in recent years to win the Champions League, which have been such excellent squads, which seem like they are on the trajectory to win the Champions League, which, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You would have expected one of these sides to have won the Champions League that he has managed.
Yeah.
And in many ways, winning the league with Man City or winning the league with Bayern feels very expected. It's the Champions League, weirdly, which feels very exceptional for Pep and for everyone else. Why is it that he has that problem? Is that
you can't necessarily level, unless you're in this in the camp, I don't know if you can necessarily level, you know, an accusation at him of like, well, you're not very good at preparing it for this, or you're not very good at getting the players' mentality ready for that. But clearly there is something which is stopping the players from performing in those scenarios. And then the problem is also that we almost asked the question at the wrong time, because, you know, if Raheem Sterling had scored the chance that he had, then the likelihood is that Lyon don't go down the other end. But we don't know that. They may have seconds later gone down the other end and scored, and it, you know, it could have been exactly the same. So there's a lot of frustration in the analysis, because it really seems like Pep Guardiola is not only benefits from, but also suffers from his own mythical presence at any club, where it's like, right, he's a bit of, you know, I mean, I don't even feel like I saw, as much as we felt like we were getting insight from the Man City doc on the Amazon, on Amazon's documentary, we didn't really get that much of a pass into the mind of the man or the way that he prepares his teams. We really got very rudimental squad footage where it's like, right, go out there and perform. And everyone's like, what a genius. Like,
there was actually some good tactical stuff in that documentary, I would argue. Yeah,
but. Would you say, I mean, do you mean a couple of the behind the scenes conversations, or?
Yeah, it was sort of, I don't think it was entirely intentional, but like you could see, and this was, you know, very true of the team at the time, you could see when he was sort of moving around certain pieces and the whiteboards in the background, that the buildup, for example, like, that's something that Manchester City have like built their attack on, is creating space by circulating the ball at the back. It always ended with Fernandinho, and like that structure is pretty, like, it's elucidated upon in the documentary.
Would you not have said though that we already knew that?
You could watch the game and see that. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe it's good to confirm that. That's also where, I don't know about you guys, but I'm always confused by this, by, I often speak to other journalists, and I spoke to a couple of people in the NBA and also a couple of people around the Premier League going, well, why don't you guys do tactical analysis? And they went, well, managers don't want you to give away their game plan. And I'm like, I said, I'm not asking you to go to them on game day and go, what's the specific plan here? I said, the likelihood is, like Bielsa said, actually, if you're at the top level, like, you already know from all the analysis that you do from all your departments, pretty much what the other team is going to try and do anyway.
Yeah.
So analysis, I mean, maybe it might give you some insight into the psyche of someone. You know, it might give you an insight into why someone might take a penalty a certain way. Maybe you don't ask them about that, or maybe you leave that out of the cup. But really, like, people know what you're going to do. And then it's really down to the talent of the players around that. And maybe that gets me onto my next question here for you, Nico, because I'm fascinated with what you think about Man City. Like, when Pep Guardiola is buying a player and he's spending the money, what do you think Pep Guardiola thinks he's spending the money on? Because it's clear that he values high quality, or whatever qualities it is that he values in those players, he thinks is worth spending that money. Otherwise, if it was possible to play Pep football with any of these players, he would just coach them that way. So yeah, there's clearly a quality that he is looking for in these players, which he can't just get from any player. So what is it that Pep is seeing and buying when he buys a player from what you can see?
I think they bring a specific skill set. You know, a lot of people, for example, have criticized Otamendi in his time there. And obviously, I think, you know, Otamendi was a transfer pre-Pep. But he has got a lot of time under Pep because of the abilities that he has. Realistically, without sort of engaging the meme that is Nico Otamendi at this point, he has excellent ball progression through the middle with his feet, not necessarily dribbling, but passing. And then he's also, when he was in Spain and he was partnered with Mustafi, he can be a really excellent, aggressive defender in situations where the press breaks and there's a counter on and it's a 1v1 situation. He's talented in those situations. It's just that by the nature of the position and by the nature of defending, defenders don't often come out superior in those situations. You know, they have to be aided by the system or other defenders, the goalkeeper, or whatever. So he has found a lot of time and found a lot of time in title-winning seasons for Manchester City, despite, you know, the ire that he accrues for Manchester City fans, because he has a skill set. So I think when Pep Guardiola or whoever is responsible for buying players and you know, talking to Pep Guardiola about the players that are going to be part of the squad, look at players and decide whether they want them to be part of the team. It's what can they do and what are they good at doing, and does that, is that something that we need in the team? Chris and I were talking about Nathan Ake, for example, prior to the pod, and I think what Nathan Ake brings is he has a positional awareness, understanding of where he needs to be within a system that possesses the ball, and he also progresses the ball really well, which is what a team like Manchester City needs and does really well. John Stones is someone that progresses the ball really well, but unlike Otamendi, doesn't have the physical attributes or doesn't have the physical capacity to be very good in 1v1 situations or physical situations. So I think it's just about the skill set. It's, does the skill set match what the team needs in a specific position?
Mm-hmm. Well, clearly not. Otherwise, you'd be in the Champions League final. you know. Although, yeah, in many ways, you've got to feel... a quick word, Kristen, on the narrative around Raheem Sterling's finishing. Because at this point, it just seems to be a bit of a stick to beat him with. And players are going to miss chances ultimately. But I guess, you know...
It is a pretty insane chance to miss, though.
I mean, it was a very insane chance to miss, but then there were also a lot of people who were kind of waiting for... they almost wait for those moments, and actually Raheem has scored some great goals this season.
Yeah, you know, for sure. Well, that's the funny thing about, like... I'll also... Sorry to interject once again, but the funny thing about the... Because my friend Bobby Gardner, who... works in football now. Wrote a piece for The Ringer a long time
ago. He's inside of football. Wow.
He's inside of the football now. It's incredible. Wow. I'm really proud of him. Wow. He wrote a piece for The Ringer a while ago about Raheem Sterling, and there was a moment in the Amazon documentary where the brilliance of Raheem Sterling isn't necessarily that he's going to score all those chances, because his finishing, I think anecdotally, probably isn't that good. But the encouraging thing about him is that not only as like a playmaker and creating chances for other players does he excel and is he sort of towards the top, but he gets in those positions so much that finishing is something that you can work on. It's a trait that is in some way enhanceable, or you can improve upon it. But having the mental capacity or footballing IQ to get into those situations so consistently, while it is also something that you can enhance, is something a little bit more complex. And that's what makes him such an exciting player, but obviously didn't pan out.
It didn't pan out. Chris, the narrative in the UK is obviously not favorable, but at some point I get the feeling that, you know, while we're busy castigating all these young players, I don't know. I guess we kind of believe that, in some way that the fire will make them better. And then when they do well at the Euros, then we'll go, see, you are good.
It's funny. There was a moment in the PSG game where Neymar and Mbappe broke through. It was just Angelino at the back. And they sort of messed it up, I think. Mbappe played it behind Neymar. He slipped and it falls down. And there was a moment where Darren Fletcher said, how do two players that talented mess that up? And I thought, you know what, that's kind of the Sterling issue in a nutshell, is that we just don't really accept human error in football. I don't know why. We could probably opine for hours on all of that stuff. But I just think that, yes, sometimes players are going to miss those chances. And I think, as XG has taught us, that you can almost work that out right down to the number. So, yeah, it's a massive chance, and I'm sure one that will frustrate Sterling until, you know, for the rest of his days. But that's one of those instances where I don't really think you can apply much science or rhyme or reason to it. It's just a very poor finish from him, and yeah, it gives, I think, a degree of confirmation bias to what we perceive his weaknesses as, but I'm not fully convinced there's actually any validity in the idea that he's a bad finisher just because of how many goals he's scored the last few years.
Yeah. But we move on, and Leon clearly move on into the next round. We spent a long time getting over Man City, but actually, do we believe that Leon have any opportunity to win this here, or is it just that they're just going to get absolutely steamrolled by a Bayern team who are the clear favourites in this competition now, Nico?
Are they the clear favourites now? Is that the betting odds?
I mean, in my mind, they are because of the mentally weak PSG.
10-1 in Lawrence McKenna's mind. Get your bets in there.
I'll give you those odds.
I think the interesting thing about obviously this situation is that it's not a two-legged tie anymore. It's a single game knockout, and that makes it. I think that changes things a lot for coaches and their approach and the players as well. Is that, you know, anything can happen over 90 minutes, as we saw with City. But Bayern are obviously, nonetheless, regardless of how we see, you know, the favoritism of and the quality of these teams, it's not like the goals that they scored against Barcelona carry over. They demolished a pretty, let's say, tactically inept Barcelona team. So, yes, are Bayern, I would consider them and PSG to be pretty similar with regards to their chances of winning it at this point. But yeah, obviously Bayern are considerably better than this Lyon team, but we saw this Lyon team put out a Manchester City that were also considerably better than them. So who knows what can happen.
Kristen, Barcelona. What the fuck?
That's what it says in the doc, actually, folks.
It is actually what it says in the doc, which is why I'm just trying to follow the notes.
I mean, you could argue it's been leading to this. I don't think results.
How many years
happened by accident? It was just horrific, and I'm not even a Barcelona fan, and I have no links to that football club at all. But you know, even the Coutinho brace at the end, I thought the assist was bad enough. If ever you needed sort of a quick summarization of where it's gone wrong for Barcelona, the player they loaned to Bayern Munich comes on, gets an assist, scores two goals, and makes it 8-2 as they crash out of the Champions League. It's a very sad situation to watch, I have to be honest, because we are firmly witnessing the, I guess you could say, dissolving, the evaporation of what was a pretty iconic European team. And that's not to say that they can't get back there, but it's going to take a lot of work. And I think it's going to take time and patience. And the worry I have is that Barcelona don't seem to have a lot of that. The talk is they're about to play Ronald Koeman, which I'm sure we can come on to that. But yeah, it's just...
Well, no, please do come on to that now, because, I mean, it's quite fascinating, really, isn't it? If you want to try and keep Lionel Messi, the best thing to do is to get Ronald Koeman.
Yeah, it's interesting. They're not the only team that I think have been guilty of this. The idea of leaning on a former player because there is some sort of esoteric, intrinsic value that they bring that cannot be replicated by an outsider. We've seen Man United do it with Solskjaer, Chelsea with Lampard, Milan did it with Gattuso as well. Goodness, completely forgot this even happened. Juventus have just done it with Pirlo. It's very much, I think, a trend at the minute to do it.
The problem, I think it always has been too.
The problem I think you've got is that there are very few clubs that do it sort of successfully. Ajax is one to me that I think integrates its former players into influential roles post-playing career very well. You have Edwin van der Sar, Mark Overmars. I think van der Sar is in charge of marketing. Overmars is sporting director. So there's an ability to reintegrate people that are, I guess, aware of the traditions and things like that, or even just understand how the club operate. I think it's so easy to convince yourself that there's some kind of cauldron of witch's brew that only certain people can understand about a football club. A lot of the time, it really is just a case of we were winning. That's what a lot of people's best time with a club is. We were winning and we were doing it well. And it's then sort of trying to find the correlations with what was contributing to that success that I think is where the actual detail comes in.
Is there then a bit of a problem that it seems that Barcelona have let their eye off the ball a little bit here, and they are not as well, they just don't seem focused at all, because the winning culture was almost assumed. It was like, in many ways, the idea where Pep Guardiola, you know, did make it feel inherent as if Barcelona couldn't lose became a bit of a problem.
I think these are the things that I think you can definitely point to as being issues. There's been a drop in, I would say, the talent level coming out of La Masia. That some of that has to fall on the club. Some of it is just how good are the players that you're getting in. I think to me, what they have greater influence over has absolutely been the transfer policy. Whether it's Coutinho that we talked about, Ousmane Dembele, not getting Asensio, Takefusa Kubo, going back to Japan and then Real Madrid snapping him up. Sort of Barcelona just seemed to completely forget the guy even existed. And now he again looks like a decent young prospect, is on loan at Villarreal this season, or will be. That to me is where I look at it and think, yeah, the people making the decisions on the recruitment side of things have massively messed up. And so now you've created this situation where, for me, a pretty good example of the logjam is you have Sergio Busquets, who is wonderfully talented, has tremendous pedigree. You then have also got Frankie de Jong. Frankie de Jong really wants to be where Sergio Busquets is. That's not to say they're identical players, but that's the sort of role that he wants to inhabit. And I think when they moved him centrally against Bayern, de Jong looked a lot more comfortable than playing, I think it was wide, trying to get my bearings at the minute as I'm thinking of it. It was wide of the midfield three, let's put it that way. And it just doesn't work. And it's a really basic thing. And it's just the idea of, okay, we're getting this player, we're spending a boatload of money on them. How are we going to integrate them? Where is the position? Because the truth is, at that level now, you can't just throw players on a field and hope that it works. I really don't think you can. People might
point to... Is that part of the problem?
That's not true, but I just don't believe it. And I think what would scare me if I was a Barcelona fan now was that not only have Bayern made some really clever moves of late, Alphonso Davies is one of them. I was a big fan of Davies from the moment he came through at Vancouver. Even I didn't think he would grow this quickly in such a short amount of time. But people like that, they just bossed them physically. They were quicker all over the field. They really were. And that, again, that's sort of where we can point to the tactical elements and these little nuances. But what stuck out to me personally watching it was just how much more aggressive Bayern were. They really did ride roughshod over them. And I think to get that kind of quality back into this Barcelona team, or to introduce it, you're going to have to get a lot of different players in there.
Nick, that's where it leads on to Barcelona rebuild. Discuss the idea of what a rebuild means, and if you can even rebuild with Messi at this point in his career.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's difficult because as I saw the headlines rolling through with the ESPN FC and all the other, you know, major media outlets talking about the implosion of Barcelona after, you know, the demolition by Bayern Munich, it's one of those things that, like, we've been seeing slowly over the past couple of years, the sort of degradation of Manchester United as a club and their expectations. You know, they went from consistently winning titles to struggling, let's say, to qualify for the Champions League, to not qualifying for the Champions League, and so on and so forth. So it's certainly within the realm of possibility that a club as big and as monetarily successful as Barcelona start to degrade a little bit. But what I want to question is that, which I think has legitimate grounds, is this really the downfall of Barcelona? Obviously, Chris alluded to a lot of the maybe systemic or squad issues that they have at the team right now. If you look at their first team, it's a lot of older players that have maybe more sentimental value than actual use value. But, you know, in 5 years, are we going to be looking at a team that is like Manchester United struggling to qualify for Europe, or just a little bump in the road? I think all of that is sort of contingent on how they grandfather out Lionel Messi, if that's even possible, and how, you know, you handle that situation as a whole, because it's almost an impossibility imagining him going somewhere else, but also how that would work financially. You know, who could even afford him? Who could afford his wages? And if that isn't possible, then
people, that's for sure, yeah.
Exactly. And if that isn't possible, then how do you play Messi in his latter years, right? Like, his production certainly hasn't significantly decreased. If anything, over the past couple of years, he's become more versatile and more sort of holistic in his ability to contribute to others, as well as continue to put up decent goal numbers himself. And I think PSG actually tonight were a perfect example of what an isolated but still structured system looks like. PSG and Thomas Tuchel specifically made a system for Neymar to pretty much roam freely and connect with the variety of other talented players that they have there. Has that structure been available to Lionel Messi since maybe Luis Enrique's departure? I don't think so. That's probably the saddest part about all of this, is that he hasn't had the coaching to match his level of talent for quite some time now. So the implosion or restructuring of Barcelona is entirely, as it always has been probably, contingent upon this one player. And they have shown no ability to navigate those waters particularly well in the past couple of years. And I think that's where the main worry comes from.
I guess then, Chris, the question for me comes through, would Barcelona, I know this sounds crazy, be good? Would it be good for them to cash in on Messi now? And you know, essentially rebuild without someone like Messi, or because, you know, from what you see inside the club and from what you hear inside the club, Messi isn't exactly the best or most revolutionary leader that they need right now. He doesn't seem like that kind of a player. That's not a criticism of him. It's just not the kind of guy that he's looking to be or is right now. Yeah, because even when I saw him the other night, he passed the ball. It went not where he wanted it, and he just walked away.
Yeah, that wasn't great to see at all. I must be honest, there's part of the whole thing that reminds me a little bit of when Wayne Rooney was getting ready to leave Manchester United, in the sense that everyone agreed he was still a very good footballer, but the pool of potential teams that would want to take that on was actually quite small. Now he ultimately has ended up at Derby County via MLS. That's not where I think Lionel Messi's going. MLS feels somewhat viable, truth be told. I know that teams are always kind of flirting with his agent a bit about, is he ready, is he ready, is he ready?
Could an MLS team afford him, like, at all?
You know what, I've learned anything about MLS, it's they will absolutely find the money when they need to. and if you think that there's a chance that it could happen, and equally you think about all of the potential revenues you would make back just on what you do, I'm not for a second falling into that trap of you could pay for it with shirt sales. I know you can't do that, but the global exposure, the marketing opportunities off the back of that, it's a type of growth that MLS clubs would absolutely love and are yearning for. I think most clubs, to be honest, are yearning for, but MLS clubs especially. In terms of Barcelona selling him, the trouble you've almost got with him, it's a little bit of a legacy decision whereby he's so associated with that club. The idea of selling him and putting him on the transfer list feels like such a sacrilegious suggestion. Yeah. I think ultimately that's kind of the problem that they have run into, which many a club, in fairness, has run into. I'm sure you could talk about it with Liverpool and Steven Gerrard and Jamie Carragher. There's a point where the legacy overshadows the ability. And it's not that Lionel Messi's a bad footballer. He's a very good footballer still. But it's the idea that the situation he's in now is not helping anyone, because I read something recently which I thought had a really good quote in it, that Tom Brady's wife, Giselle, said something along the lines of, "My husband can't throw the fucking pass and catch it." And when I watch Messi a lot of the times, that's the predicament he's in. He's making the passes that he would want for himself because he's having to come deeper. The turnaround time required to fix this squad is so long, I think, that you're just going to end up sapping what little he's got left. And by the time you're ready, you've got no reason, you've got no option, I think, but to get rid of him. So at that point, I think, you have to start debating. Maybe it's time for MLS. I know he wanted to go back to Argentina at some point, but just float those ideas and sort of have a very frank conversation player to club and club to player and say, look, I don't know if this is working for either of us right now. Maybe it is best if they do it, because even just the money that they're paying in his wages, that's a large sum that you can start to play with and invest in new players. Again, as sacrilegious as that sounds.
Well, I'm not sure how sacrilegious it does sound. I mean, is it really?
But it goes against it goes against the narrative that the marketing side of this constructed, which is, again, in tandem with the actual results. So everybody knows about this, you know, idealistic, how many of the, you know, 9 of the 11 players in the Champions League final against Manchester United all those years ago were La Masia products, Gerard Piqué, Carles Puyol, Sergio Busquets, and Iniesta, Xavi, Messi, whoever else. And that's, I think that's what Chris is talking about there, and I completely agree, in the sense that, you know, we know the story of Lionel Messi. He went to his family made great sacrifice to go to Barcelona from Argentina, and he had a growth problem. And you know, everybody doubted him, and didn't think he was going to be the player that you know he eventually became. And the club put their faith in him, and you know he sort of returned the favor tenfold, and that's the magical little story we all want to believe. But at the end of the day, like Chris is suggesting there, is the dream, is the narrative, is all of this now over because they're in a place where they need to move on, not just one, but a bunch of players from their first team if they're to be, you know, as competitive as they want to be in Europe and in the league. Does part of that entail moving on, you know, a player that has essentially served as their sort of humble, soft-spoken figurehead for a number of years.
Yeah, if that is indeed the actual character of Messi, not what we have just assumed.
I think it's just a guy that likes Pepsi, I think.
It's just a guy that just loves soft drinks.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah. Is that humble though, Nika? I don't know if that's humble.
I don't know. I think it's devoid of any kind of human characteristics. When we see him retire, he's just going to go back to his house and drink a bunch of Pepsi. That's pretty much it.
I believe that is exactly what Pepsi intend for the rest of his life. I'm not sure it's a happy existence, but okay. And not that Pepsi is bad. If Pepsi have heard this, I think your product is neutral.
Can we influence the other direction with a sponsorship? But let us know.
Yeah. Oh, believe me, Chris. Do you look at this buy inside though, and just think, wow? I mean, they are so versatile. There's so much fantastic. There's so many fantastic options there. When Lewandowski is not switched on, then someone else is. You know, you look at the midfield, it seems so adaptable. The back line, like you say, has got so many different amazing pieces in it. Do we underestimate Bayern in recent years?
No, I don't think we underestimate them. I was thinking about this today. I might be about to really just annoy a lot of fans of the Bundesliga.
Please.
I feel as if Bayern, they've done a fantastic job of building this squad And they've got such a sweet spot now where I think the ruthlessness they showed in getting rid of the likes of Hummels and people like that and bringing, I mean, exploiting the market to get the likes of Gnabry for the price they did. We talked about Davies, Leon Goretzka, sort of just picking up these pieces from their domestic market from well below market value has been excellent and deserves a lot of credit. There's also part of me that feels like when I look at them, there's maybe them and PSG, but I think it's more pronounced with Bayern, where actually it's seen as it's seen as an absolute scandal if they don't win the league. And so actually there's not, I think, as much outward pressure on Bayern to, they have to really blow both their own feet off to not win the Bundesliga. So I think when it comes to sort of European competition, things like that, I'm almost just a little bit less impressed. I feel bad because I've got a Bayern scarf in the bedroom there that someone gave me, but
turncoat.
It's just, I don't know.
Well, they are also head and shoulders above the rest of the league financially, like head and shoulders and feet.
Probably. Yeah, that's why I say it's a little bit like PSG. You know, I mean, Monaco won the league the other year, but that was kind of built on a lot of very good prospects and Kylian Mbappe coming in to the fold when he did and all this kind of stuff. Whereas like Dortmund had a good run at it, bless them. But when push came to shove, they just didn't have enough to get across the line. And even then, sort of when it's felt like, oh, Bayern might not win the league, it's because, you know, Carlo Ancelotti just decided that it was a holiday camp. and then I think it was Niko Kovac, who, again, just didn't translate well to a big club. And Hansi Flick's done a tremendous job to turn them round. But at the same time, to me, a lot feels like just filling the tank up on a sports car. Do you know what I mean? I don't think it's a massive turnaround. I think they're just so, you could argue maybe a little bit like Juventus, although I think that's about to be eroded in the next 12, 18 months, where they've just got enough ducks in a row that really the league season is a foregone conclusion and it just becomes about Europe. Where to their credit, the way they played against Barcelona, I think was the most complete performance I've seen in Europe this season, genuinely.
Yeah, I think a lot of fans are looking at this and thinking, God, if we had our team there who just applied just even just a little effort, then, you know, we might be seeing our team winning the Champions League. As PSG are now seeing, Nico, as everything fell into place against Leipzig just on Tuesday night, when they put on the best performance PSG have ever put on, Nico, and they prove they're not just playing a bunch of farmers. These guys can also play well-paid and well-trained farmers from Germany.
I like that. I'm not sure it will please the fans of the Bundesliga that listen to the podcast, but
IBGAF.
Very good. No cursing on the podcast. We are a family. Thanks. We're a family podcast now.
Yeah, exactly. Fuck it.
But yeah, no, I mean, I think it's an interesting point because as I was sort of tweeting some of my thoughts as the game went on, and it was a very good performance from PSG and something that I think Tuchel is sort of in the same school of Guardiola in the sense that, you know, you made the point about Liverpool's press and, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And Leipzig did some very similar things that Liverpool did, the midfield pressing traps and sort of exploiting the weaknesses that are inherent to possessing the majority of the ball. The interesting thing that I was thinking about was I was having a conversation with Grace Robertson the other day, avid Liverpool fan, great writer. She was talking about how, you know, her take sort of on the things that had gone wrong for Manchester City against Lyon was that sometimes maybe he expects too much tactically speaking and conceptually speaking from the players that he has and the things that they're supposed to do. And, you know, maybe that's true specifically of some of the Manchester City players, but that certainly wasn't true of any of the PSG players tonight. And that was what was so, I think, encouraging about this performance is that this game was played at an extremely high level tactically. You know, there were players that had, they had a very conscientious idea as to what was going to occur if they didn't put the exact right pass in the right place and how to provoke certain pressing actions and what Leipzig was trying to do in terms of provoking them to pass it to certain players in certain spots of the field. So I think, you know, we talk about Bayern being so promising, and I think there is an element of that where they are just so aggressive and they have a system and a you know, a gaggle of players that is extremely talented and also extremely physical, which plays into the one game aspect. But from PSG's perspective, you know, they're playing at an extremely high level, both physically and also from a tactical standpoint. So this is definitely their best shot in quite a few years.
And that's part of it here, isn't it, Chris, is that it does feel, now that the stars are aligning for these guys, but also that the likes of Neymar, the likes of Mbappe have gritted their teeth a little more than they were willing to do before, or realize that they possibly have to do that. It won't just come across in an easy way for them, whereas before maybe they assumed that because of their talent or whatever the situation, it might just fall into their lap because it had done that before. Maybe Tuchel, maybe also a mixture of what Barcelona haven't shown more recently, which is, you know, learning from the scenarios they find themselves in, and even better, looking at their opponents and going, what do they have that we don't, seems to be what is getting PSG into this situation. Because this evening, it's fair to say that they, you know, I think PSG do not thrive when they are painted to either be the underdogs or the bad guys. And tonight they almost... they didn't want to be the...
Well, they were playing an energy drink company, so...
and what is worse...
In some cases, literal energy versus human energy, I guess.
Love that, yeah.
Soft power against sugary power. Yeah.
That sweet, sweet guarine power.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, great. Right. Make your point one more time, Chris.
Right. I should nail it this time in theory. I think it, you know, PSG's performance was impressive. It was aggressive. I don't think they gave Leipzig much opportunity to build any kind of momentum in the game. But I think there's part of me that expected that because that triumvirate of Neymar, Mbappe, Di Maria, they were good. I thought Di Maria in particular was very good.
Yeah.
But I would kind of expect that. They've benefited, I think, from the fact that they've played Atalanta and Leipzig, and sure, there's an inherent pressure of if you fail, you kind of get laughed out of the competition. But I don't think PSG have necessarily pulled up any trees with beating those two teams personally.
Yeah, the other side of that being, you know, that PSG are out because they lost the moral competition tonight. Leipzig, of course, are the underdogs. They have been the underdogs from day one. They're plucky. They've been around for not long, blah, etc., etc. What does this tell us about being able to build a club in a very short space of time while everyone else is dithering? What are they doing right that other people seem to be doing wrong? And why is it that some people seem to believe that it's only really in this kind of situation and not in a Manchester United or a big institution situation that you could achieve this?
Interesting that we were having a conversation about sentimentalism and, like, you know, the special sauce that one needs to run Barcelona or something like that, because that is completely devoid. It's absent in clubs like RB Leipzig. They make really intelligent decisions in terms of recruiting that are
you know, informed by all of the practices that go into scouting. It's not just analytically or statistically, but they have good people that provide a rationale, a logical rationale as to why they like certain players. Chris and I were also talking about someone like Upamecano before the podcast and how good of a player he is. But Chris mentioned that, you know, when he was in Austria, he had spent some time at defensive midfield, and I know they have some pretty interesting they have some pretty, you know, unique ways as to how they like to train some of their more talented youth prospects that gives them more ability to be flexible in their position. And again, you run into maybe what these clubs don't view as a problem, but, you know, if a player can bounce between Salzburg and Leipzig and New York, you know, you have a network of a seriously talented group of players that can go to a bunch of different places and have success at varying levels. So that's kind of the reason, I think, one of the reasons or some of the reasons behind the success behind Leipzig is that they don't take a sentimental, fundamental, or traditional approach to a lot of the stuff that is the pitfalls for some of the bigger clubs, and they benefit from that. You know, they have a extremely good recruitment and extremely good and modernized coaching system.
Mm, yeah, it is an interesting one, isn't it, Chris? Because I think, you know, whilst we're talking about other teams that aren't able to win anything, we're talking about gaps between winning and stuff, they do seem to have created somewhat of a culture, I guess, at Leipzig, which is what a lot of people weren't really expecting.
Yeah, I think, look, they've invested a lot, the Red Bull company. And, you know, it's interesting that I think a lot of people forget it's Rasenball Sport. It's not Red Bull Leipzig. I think in some ways they've almost achieved their goal.
Well, it isn't, right?
Well, like, that's my point, is that you know, there are certain aspects of this team, like Julian Nagelsmann, that have done a tremendous job of basically covering up the less than desirable aspects of this whole organization. Some of the far right elements, things like that. The fact that, like I said, they have pumped in money. It's not like...
You do not want to give the far right energy drinks.
Well, it's not like, for comparison's sake, Atalanta, where there's a slow build and it's sort of... it's done in a much more organic way, and you could, without wishing to sound pious, you could argue, you know, a more honest way, I guess, is the best word I can sum up in that moment. But yeah, like I say, it's difficult because I'm a very big fan of Tyler Adams. I think he's a wonderful footballer. I see how he has benefited from that system. They have done, I think, if I want to take away every single political aspect of it for a second, just on its sporting merits. Yeah, ooh. Setting up clubs in New York, Brazil, Austria has produced a fairly decent production line, if you will, in terms of getting players to Leipzig. My curiosity as someone living in New York is what benefit realistically is there for Red Bull in New York right now, in terms of how do they see something from that relationship come across the border, because they occasionally get a loan player, but it's usually not, to be brutally honest, a great one. And I just think that, yeah, it benefits the mothership a lot in the same way that I think NYCFC benefits Man City, because they get the likes of Jack Harrison, who will go and join Leeds and earn them a bit of money, and Zach Steffen. And it benefits Jack Harrison because he gets to England. But what it does for that club, or the cap to that club, I'm less convinced by. And so, yeah, I think you could argue even some of the fact, you know, I spoke to Jonathan Harding, who wrote the fantastic book Mensch, and the fact that Nagelsmann's picked a club that doesn't necessarily have a strong identity or long-standing history, because it means he can influence things to a greater degree. But I think we can easily get caught up into how brilliant and wonderful is Nagelsmann, how brilliant and wonderful are these players, and forget how that sausage is made.
Yep. Well, yeah, in this case, the energy drink, but yeah.
To be fair, probably similar ingredients. Yeah. Most energy drinks are made of pork. So that's completely untrue, though. I don't think anyone is going to pick me up on that, or at least I hope not. I don't know who would anyway.
We have our legal team standing by. It's just Dave in his underwear.
Yeah. The funny thing is, it's similar for the Statman Dave company. both companies operating on Dave in his underwear. And
the Atlas shrugged.
Dave was a massive Ayn Rand fan. Doesn't matter. Again, it's the same joke. We get it, Matthew. We'll get on to the finals and stuff. Probably do a special podcast for that later in the week. It'll be good to speak about that in a little bit more detail. But let's move on then from Leipzig. We've probably nailed them just enough. It does lead, though, Nico, to Lyon versus Bayern. And for me, it just seems as if Lyon maybe have peaked around too early here, or two rounds too early, if you will. Because, well, they're now playing Bayern. And, incredible as this is, they're playing Bayern.
They are, in fact, playing Bayern Munich. Yeah, we know this. We are subject to it. I don't know. I think it's an interesting thing because, as we were kind of talking about there with Munich and what they've done recruiting wise, I think to a certain extent, what's gone under the radar in the past couple of years since Pep Guardiola's departure, obviously they've had a lot of coaching turnover, but Hans-Dieter Flick is the manager right now, and he did some time studying under Joachim Löw in Germany, as well as various assistants at Bayern Munich. And, Bayern have a discernible identity on the ball. They're a possession-heavy team, and that's obviously the nature of how they have to play, given the quality in the Bundesliga and all these things. But if you've seen how they played specifically against some of the teams in the Champions League, they occupy like a similar possession kind of exploitative shape with four or five across the front, and they rely on the brilliance of Thiago to progress the ball through the midfield and do that efficiently. So it's going to be, I would say, tactically a pretty similar match to the one against Manchester City. The interesting thing to see would be is if it pans out in the same way. I think Bayern have more security in that regard because they have better athletes in certain positions. They can take a bit more risks. They have David Alaba and Alphonso Davies and, a variety of other players that can cover them in situations where defenders are isolated. But I think it will generally be a pretty similar game to the one we saw against City. I have more faith in Bayern Munich's ability to come through that, not only because of the defenders, but also because Lewandowski is having a godlike year. And Müller seems to be finding his feet again in linking up with Lewandowski. I think it's going to be pretty similar to that. So it'll be interesting to see how that pans out.
Let's move leagues now, Kristen. And someone that you and I have always been fascinated with, Antonio Conte. Has he overachieved or underachieved this season? And I mean that in Europe and also the league.
That's a good question. I think it was always going to take time for him to build. I think maybe we're looking at it through the lens of how quickly he did that with Chelsea.
And with Juve as well, to be fair. And he's always been successful in some capacity in his first year at, well, all of his massive appointments.
And I think the situation with Chelsea, that turnaround, if you will, or that success in the Premier League was very much helped by the fact that he really did inherit a team that looked like a tire fire that I don't think was quite as bad as their league position suggested. It was just they hated Jose Mourinho, to be brutally honest.
Yeah.
Whereas I think with this one, I don't think he'll be necessarily delighted with how things have gone in the league. But if you could come away with the Europa League playing as well as they have with Lukaku, again, I think back to his peak, which, again, that's a separate issue about Man United and all that kind of stuff that I don't think is worth discussing. But with him looking as sharp as he is, I think he's done very well this first season. I don't think he's underachieved. I think he's probably hit that sweet spot in the middle, because I don't think the Europa League should be seen as a gigantic achievement, but I think it's something for them to celebrate at the same time, because it's a European Cup, and that is not anything I think that should be scoffed at. And he's building a side that looks, again, very... we talk about aggressive a lot tonight, and that's kind of what I think of with Conte's football throughout. The trouble we've always talked about with him is how does he manage those separate competitions when he's got European and domestic ambitions running side by side? It has been difficult for him. Now, I think some of the benefit he's had this time round is the fact that COVID has basically taken 3 months away. Them winning the Europa League, if that's what happens, will be a fantastic achievement in itself. It's then how they will carry that form into next season, I think, that will ultimately define whether he's overachieved or underachieved, because I think they've got a fantastic chance already, without a ball even being kicked, of winning the league next season.
Just because of what's going on at Juve?
Yeah, just because we genuinely have no idea. I think even anyone who's saying, oh, Juve will definitely win the league, you're taking a punt. You're absolutely taking a punt. I'm sorry. We've got no idea what Pirlo is going to be like next season or how that team will adapt to him.
I mean, Nico, you seem to agree.
Well, an absence of an idea is not necessarily no idea, I would say. It's just... you know, there's a lot filling that empty void. So
you've got a lot of smart words there, boy. What are you trying to say?
I don't think he'll be doing particularly well. Equally, Juventus are financially dominant in Serie A, and they have a lot of good players. So maybe average. Who knows?
That's the other thing with Pirlo as well, is that, you know, when I've read sort of these little quotes about how he wants to do things, again, it's a lot of sort of buzzwords about I want to play this, I want to play that. I say the same thing when I load up Football Manager, unless I actually
Really?
Yeah, you know, it's all great to say I want to play aggressive football or attacking football. That's, you know, it's no different to putting bread in the toaster and saying I want toasted bread. Like, unless you're actually building the machine yourself, that's what the best guys get paid the big bucks for. Simply the idea. Everybody wants to play good football. Yes, there are certain scopes of difference in terms of yeah. I want to be reactive or proactive or whatever. But in terms of how you actually translate that into your ideas and the group and how that all interacts with each other and how people and players relate to each other in that tactical system, that's where the difficulty is in management. It's not identifying what you want to do, it's then making it happen.
That is the worry, I guess, is that Juve haven't finished the interview process and they went, sure, we'll give you the job. And he went, no, I'm just saying, I want to play football like I am. I have no idea how to achieve this.
That's just how I would do it. It's up to you guys.
It's a long-term aspiration for me. I've just got to say this. Just goes into training and just starts going, guys, should we just play like Ajax? Cool, just play like Ajax. That'd be fantastic. We did discuss that somewhat earlier in the week on the podcast, so I'll avoid putting the listeners through PLO twice. But I agree with what you're saying, Chris, and those follow-up thoughts seem very prevalent for a lot of people who are looking at the worry of PLO. Having said that, though, I mean, look at Inter Milan, Nico. I'm trying to work out whether I like them or not. They do seem a bit like, again, like any Conte team, an island of misfit toys. There's something quite likable about that. And
I think there's something quite likable about just supporting a post Manchester United Lukaku, right?
Yeah, and also just the fact that Manchester United, I don't know, he felt very much like he was being cast away from Manchester United, and there was a bit of a dismissiveness and a bit of a... you know, just in general, like a lot of ignorance around Lukaku. And now to see that dominant performance in so many ways against Shakhtar, who, you know, maybe if we're talking about writing narrative here, are the ultimate journalist sort of wet dream in terms of narrative, I guess, right now, for good and bad reasons. You know,
it's fantastic. It has been great to watch him this season. And I've watched plenty of Inter Milan because I do like Conte's team and I like Conte, but they're not, they aren't currently in their final form, maybe it's fair to say. And the worry here, I think because Conte, feels, a lot of people from the outside feels that Conte may be leaving, is that we might not see this come to fruition. And actually, it's quite frustrating because I'd quite like to see this come to fruition. I'm wondering, though, whether Conte is using the situation at Inter to motivate the players right now and, spur them on to win the Europa League final for sort of a look, I'm leaving. And then when they do win, he'll go, oh, okay, fine, I'll stop.
Certainly a possibility. And I agree with you. I think there's a beauty to the transitional nature of a fully formed or fully evolved Antonio Conte team, as we saw at Chelsea. And it would be nice to see in the years coming a little bit of a break from Juventus just winning and winning and winning Serie A titles. But there's significant obvious disagreement between Antonio Conte and the financial support that's brought by the investors that have put money into the club as a whole. I like the spirit of the team because, as we mentioned there, I think there are several likable characters in that squad. Alexis Sanchez stars as a very big part of that for me because I've always enjoyed him as a player. But right. Who knows where it'll go. Maybe, I mean, we're in a post-coronavirus, or not post-coronavirus world, but, pandemic world. And maybe the interesting thing about the Juve appointment for me as well with regards to this situation is that I don't think it's outside of the realm of the possibility that Pirlo maybe never gets an actual game and they just decide to go with Allegri or Conte if he leaves Inter before he even gets the opportunity to take reign of the first team. So,
right. Okay. Yeah, I get that. Yeah. So you're a great interim coach. Thanks for everything.
Opportunity, I think, to go back to Conte after the failed project that was Maurizio Sarri, which I don't think was all his fault, but who knows? Then I think you do it,
Yeah, and then you just wonder whether Conte would do that. Also then Ronaldo under Conte, all this sort. How much more ripped can Ronaldo get? It's going to be fascinating to find out. Having said that though, Chris, this is setting up for Inter to take the Europa League. I know Sevilla are still a fantastic side, but you would say that Inter, after that dominant performance, are the favourites for this final. A lot of people want and willing them to win this just because of the narrative around players like Lukaku, et cetera, et cetera. I want them to win it, put it that way.
Yeah, but Sevilla kind of love that whole shtick, if you will, of being the underdogs. I think it made them a lot more comfortable against Manchester United, for example. And I thought they were actually, as much as Man United wasted a lot of chances, I thought, I just, maybe it's a bias in me, but I just love watching Ever Banega play football. And if it turns out he does go to Saudi Arabia, I know he's agreed a deal there. I don't know if that will officially go through, or he might try and change and get out of it. I don't know. But yeah, he is a wonderful football player to watch. And I think when I look at Sevilla in general, they will be the underdog, but they'll absolutely relish that. They'll love that, in fact. I think they'd rather give into the ball and see what they can do and see what they can break down. And for that reason alone, I just don't think it's a foregone conclusion. I think this will be a lot tighter than people will make out.
It pretty much leads perfectly on to Manchester United, doesn't it, Nico? We thought they were through. I thought that this project was finished. He finally resurrected them back from the dead. Manchester United were ready to reclaim the title next season as Jadon Sancho fits effortlessly into the team.
Or so we thought. Or so we thought.
What's happening? I don't really know. Like, what's happening with Manchester United? I mean, surely all the analysis of them relying on the talent of the players and not necessarily a repeatable system was just lies. This is Manchester United, they are an institution.
They are, in fact, an institution.
For years, the rhetoric of players being good, et cetera, bullshit like that, has really helped them through. And now here we are, years later, regretting the false narratives that we've told ourselves time after time. People feeling underwhelmed by what the summer holds now that they can't get Jadon Sancho, allegedly.
Yeah, I mean, it's an indication of where the club has gone in recent years, that so much of their transfer policy and their fate as a club with regards to the kinds of players that they can get rests pretty significantly on what they can do at the very end of the season. And, you know, I've said it before, say it again, what has become clear under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is that it's less about a system and more about what has been discussed ad nauseum by Manchester United fans again and again and again, which is, we see every summer, well, if we shift out five players and we buy these other six, then we'll be, you know, then we'll be in good shape. Then we'll do this, that, and the other. When in actuality, I don't think there has been an actualization of the maximum potential of the players that they have. And they've done well in recent times. They had a like decent run towards sort of the end of the season, but a lot of that is predicated on some pretty interesting refereeing decisions with regards to Manchester United and again, the individual talent of certain players. So with them obviously not being able to qualify for the Champions League, it's another year that's delayed in this project. And you wonder how that stales over the next year with Solskjaer at the helm.
I'll be interested to see. There is plenty more Manchester United discussion to be had. We try sometimes to have it when Dave isn't on the podcast.
Never works out that way, but
it never really works. I mean, it's never worked out as positively as when Dave is on the podcast. But you know, we can but try. Chris, speaking of positive chat, let's go to someone who used to love Manchester but now hates it with a passion. Joe Hart is finally the goalkeeper for Tottenham Hotspur, and it's fair to say, Chris, he might be the number one choice next season.
I mean, I hope not. I'm not even a Spurs fan. I don't even think Adam wants that.
Right.
No, I think, yeah, this is the other thing we're going to have to sort of adjust to, I think, a little bit, is that coronavirus means that the way that clubs spend is going to be drastically different. And for a club as, I want to say, parsimonious as Tottenham.
okay. Yeah.
The fact that they've, I think, understandably put more of an emphasis on let's fix the midfield, so let's get Højbjerg in, I think. I read a report today.
Joe Hart. This fixes everything.
Yeah, well, I think they're interested in Sangare of Toulouse. So they've prioritised the thing. The midfield is a key aspect of where they need to improve. Joe Hart is a backup on probably not a lot of money. It means that essentially their young goalkeepers can go out on loan and don't need to just sit in that horrible vacuum of not playing minutes. I don't think it's a terrible idea. He might play a couple of cup games at most.
What's third to Michel Vorm?
I don't know. It'd be Gazzaniga, wouldn't it? Lloris, Gazzaniga, and then Hart. I mean, look, it's probably not where he predicted his career would be 5 years ago. I think he...
No, exactly, yeah.
And that element, I don't know if it's maybe Euro 2016 or when that moment came, but to watch a goalkeeper's career... I don't want to say crumble, that sounds harsh, but to watch the momentum drain out of a goalkeeper like that and the confidence drain out of him in a similar way to what I saw with Paul Robinson, it is very disappointing. Robinson, I think, recovered a little bit with Blackburn, but was never at that same level again. I don't think Hart's quite had that recovery, but to his credit, he's been refreshingly honest about, you know, what he needs to do and how he needs to improve. So you could argue...
Well, it's because everyone around him was being so, as you put it, refreshingly honest about him.
Probably. I think to that end, Spurs have thought, you know what, let's take a flyer on it, on a goalkeeper that could come in and do something. He's not terrible as a third choice option, I don't think.
I'm going to really start being more refreshingly honest with people. No, it's not harsh at all. I'm refreshingly honest. I believe that is also Fox News's new line. refreshingly honest. Nico, speaking of which, your love for the right wing, you know, do you think that this Mourinho-esque shape of Spurs is the right way for Spurs to go? Because there are times where I look at this, and obviously a lot of people go, oh, it's Mourinho building. It's Mourinho building for Mourinho. But when I look at other people's squads, I often think, okay, well, I can see how X player would work under another manager. You know, I can see how, you know, even looking at Sarri moving on from Juventus, who have only just won the league and crashed out of the Champions League, I still look at that squad and think, okay, well, any manager that's coming in can still rebuild in some way. There are still some parts there that I still see as even semi-useful. Mourinho always seems to leave teams in such a Mourinho mold that it makes it very difficult if you want to move away from Mourinho. But then maybe Spurs have overcommitted at this point.
Yeah, I certainly get that point, and I completely agree. I was having a conversation with Nathan Clark and Chris Miller of the Extra Inch podcast.
Right,
yeah. And, you know, they kind of have the same sentiments about Joe Hart as well. I think they were making some arguments that, you know, if it's not that much money, then it fills the English quota that Premier League teams have to have. But that could have been done with a youth player, and there's certain options there, and probably even there with less money. But equally, the point that it made me think about was, I think a couple of years ago, I wrote an article about Hugo Lloris under Pochettino, and how his inability with his feet sort of limited the system and limited what they were able to do on the ball, especially as a team looking to construct, you know, adequate or efficient possession play and do all the things that other possession teams do. And this is exactly what you're saying there with, you know, how can someone else build when Joe Hart is the poster boy for a goalkeeper who's specific tactical moment in the landscape of football kind of passed them by within 6 months or a year, you know, with the advent of more progressive and proactive play coming to the Premier League. He was just, it was a skill set that he had never worked on and never, you know, has never been able to add to his game. And so adding someone like Joe Hart to the team, regardless of how much he may play, doesn't show that Spurs are trying to go in that direction, and it doesn't show that they're going in a direction that seemed to be putting them on an upward trajectory over the past couple of years. So it's a weird decision for me.
It's a funny one, because if this signing had been made under Pochettino, I think a lot of people would maybe be spinning it in another way. They'd be going, look at this guy, Pochettino, he's able to pull guys out. But because it's under Mourinho, the framing, and obviously a very cynical Levy, a lot of people, oh, this is a signal of where Spurs are at now, one's down, blah, blah, blah. It's so interesting to see the difference in perception, Kristen, of different managers and what their tenure means for that club. Because like I say, under Poch, I think this is framed very different. All of this is framed very differently.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I had a thought like that a couple of months ago, the idea that realistically, your legacy in a club is as much written by your successor as you, because it ultimately depends what direction they take it in. If they do crash and burn, you're kind of made to look a lot better than you are. If they thrive, then a lot of times it's seen as, oh, well, you know, it was either you that laid the groundwork, or, you know, you were underperforming and they realized that potential. So I think Tottenham, to me, are an interesting club in the sense that the move to get Mourinho was very easy to interpret. It was a case of, let's try and get a trophy, I think. Let's get a born winner, in inverted commas, or a serial winner, which...
Again, serial something.
Yeah, it costs you a lot of money. It costs you the better part of 15 million a year. But then at the same time, I think, well, you aren't spending money to the tune of that either, so it doesn't quite make sense to me. So I have to be honest, Tottenham are in a funny state right now for me as an outsider looking in on them. I just don't know where Mourinho is going to take them. That's the thing. At least with Pochettino, I felt like the chart for progression was very easy to identify, because it was just about taking them from sort of a top six team into top four, maybe even a title push. I can't really say I see the same tracks for Mourinho to try and follow.
Well, which tracks would you like us to follow? Let us know on our social media over the next few weeks as football kind of disappears for a very short space of time before returning. I'm already enjoying what I thought would be weeks away, but Liverpool's pre-season in, I believe it's now Salzburg already. It's unusual, Nico, to see a weird sort of pre-season-esque thing happening during the end of the Champions League. Are you a little worried about football burnout? I'm already seeing a lack of new or fresh narrative in the league or even in the Champions League or anywhere else. It worries me. Have we used all the stories?
Well, when I wake up every day, I have an alarm set. It goes off at 7 a.m. and it's titled, "Do we have enough narrative?" You know, that's kind of what gets me up in the morning. Yeah. So that's my major concern, not, you know, the tendons of the players and so on and so forth.
Right. Okay. Yeah. They walk around clubs and goes, guys, the narrative says you don't break him for another few months, so you all need to stay healthy. All right.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You can break it Euro 2021. So we can all blame that. Not.
I think you bring up a good point, because think for a moment how much consecutive football we will now be subject to, given this specific circumstance. You know, the delayed Euros, the CONCACAF competitions, the so on and so forth. I mean,
and not only that, but I know what happens in these people's minds. Like, I know what happens for journalists. Or I know these guys are maybe, you know, more used to grinding out stories and stuff. But Chris, you must know this yourself. I know you've done the journalistic grind maybe a little bit more than Nico or I have. Come the end of the season, you know, it's not only about the players burning out. It is also about the staff and the journalists in the, you know, in the press conferences. Obviously, a press conference is live, but, you know, these people trying to squeeze every inch out of, well, no, not every inch. Sorry, that's I misspoke there.
Think of the journalists?
I'm just saying, like, people think of them.
Who will think of them?
I will finish then on this. So, what's been your favorite moment for Man City this season? Yeah,
gosh. Pep Guardiola talking to the ghost of Mikel Arteta.
Yeah, that was actually a great moment. Yeah, I was kind of hoping for an on the pitch moment, but fair.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, that rather satisfying. My second question to you, Nico, is do you like the new Man City kit?
The sort of dinosaur eggshell kind of look, the home kit?
I mean, that's definitely a very rose-tinted spectacle way of doing it, for sure.
Yeah. You know, they are a lacquer for an oil company, so why not take the inspiration for how that oil is created to the dinosaurs? Okay. So yes, I do enjoy it. I do enjoy the look, because I used to, a little personal insight, a little personal anecdote for the listeners here. Used to when I was a kid, most mornings there was a little, you know, Quaker Oats. They had the kids sort of oatmeal packets, and they had little dinosaur eggs in them that were just like kind of, I don't know what they were. I think they were just sugar shaped to dinosaurs that would be slipped into the oats, and you would make it with a little hot water, and it had sort of like, again, what I'm referring to is the dinosaur sort of pattern, dinosaur egg kind of pattern, that's why it's reminiscent for me. So yeah, it's a nice nostalgic memory that they're tapping into specifically for me.
I know that's what the designers were going for.
Have you ever had Quaker Oats children's dinosaur animal special edition? Have you ever had that?
You just went, I love it. Whatever you're thinking.
I love it. Whatever. Yeah, do it. Guys, do it.
Yeah.
Well, you know what I was going to ask you, since you're a man of culture, not to make this podcast go on for more than 2 hours, but who gives a fuck at this point? I saw a very happy picture of Mohamed Salah his nice new Nike training kit. And let me tell you, something in my shorts started moving around when I saw that Nike kit with the Liverpool logo. Yeah, my God, it just looks good, doesn't it?
It just looks good. I've just got to say, I just put it this way, right? I've never been so excited for a kit launch.
And he's had a kid. And he's had a kid launch. So that that's the worst joke I've ever made. But
no, that was
also really, really enjoyed your public castration of Adidas Creative. You know, I agree. Yeah. I watched the ad and it wasn't good. I could do better, maybe. I don't know.
I feel frustrated by it because I wasn't really criticizing. You probably could do better. I wasn't criticizing Adidas or Manchester United. It was more that I was criticizing the
Luke Shaw on the bus
that could be behind this. I was like, surely, so put it this way, right? There's Manchester United. Is it the away kit launch this week? I don't know if it's the away or the third kit, but it's the away kit. And the launch involved a video which looked like it had been edited on a mobile phone. Not that I'm saying it's bad quality, but it looked like it had been put through like one of the apps that you just sort of go, throw the clips in, give me a video.
Right.
And it just sort of does it for you.
Yes.
And then it puts a load of light leaks on to make it look professional like they used to back in, 2005.
Right.
And then put it out. And I was annoyed because I was like, well, someone will have received quite a lot of cash for this. Someone will have gone, oh, we've got a socially
distance. And you didn't receive that cash, so.
Well, it's not necessarily that I deserve that. It's more that in the time of socially conscious movements, mm-hmm. why couldn't Manchester United have gone to someone and gone, look, we need a young, cool, creative who isn't some white middle class guy to give us some sort of narrative here.
You know what I think and it's then, reminiscent of that ad? You know what I think it's reminiscent of? Remember that great Nike ad that they did, I want to say a couple of years ago now, that was like the streets of London, and it was very culturally with its ear to the floor, at least to my uncultured ear.
And
it was like going through the different parts, and it's like you're London, and this was like
run,
people take the bus, people do take public transportation, and also we want you to buy the shirt, so put the two pieces together.
Wear the shirt on the bus. I guess I felt that way, but then I read the creative was it was a tribute to the people who could not travel to the away games, and I thought, well, first of all, how many people are taking a public bus all the way to?
Well, that's like some. I didn't know that, but I'm glad you said it because that's like when a fraternity or sorority that is implicit in probably many sex crimes says that their fundraiser is to save the dolphins or something, because it is to save the dolphins and there ostensibly is some money going towards some endangered porpoise, but at the same time there are sex crimes being perpetuated, so again exploited workers, the reasoning is the people that couldn't go to the away games on the bus.
What a mole to come back into this conversation. but sex crimes.
Nigo's not making the point that anyone involved in the creative of this committed a sex crime.
Again, we're just plop that onto the legal team, which is Dave, fully erect.
Again, sex crimes. It's been really good to chat to you guys today. Thank you very much for joining us for the front three. If you want to let us know about, at some point we will do a new kit review of every team. I'm very happy with Nike this season with Liverpool. It's a change, and at the same time, it's very welcome change, and the quality seems fantastic. The players all look very happy and suave and well-dressed. That's all most people want, put it that way. And Chris, believe me, we will have time for your Newcastle review at some point. But in the meantime, tweet us, let us know what you think about your new kit for your new club. Chris, people can go join you on Twitter. Am I correct? What are you writing about this week?
Just did a piece on Nagelsmann, got a piece on Ava Benega coming in a day or two. So busy.
Love that. Very busy. Izzy Wizzy. Nico, what about you? What are you writing about? Is it Alien and their involvement in the Champions League, or what are we talking
about? Exactly that. No, as I mentioned on the last pod I was on with Adam, I'm writing a PDF that I'll be selling, hopefully published at the end of the month. 5 essays for $7. I haven't decided on the price. It's between 5 and 7. Maybe I'll hit 6. But you can buy that at the end of the month. All on film.
I shall be investing.
That's okay. You're going to get a copy for free. But Everyone else, you got to pay.
I will still invest. What's the highlight of the PDF so far? Is there anything? Is there a tidbit that you can drop for us? Is there a line that you feel particularly proud of?
I took a who directed it? I forget.
Eternity test, right?
Yep, I took a COVID test. No, what's his name? I don't know. The guy that directed 1917 also directed another war film called Jarhead. And I connected that to some pedantic and probably boring philosophy theory. Yes, that's it.
It's nothing Foucauldian.
No Foucault in this one, at least not yet.
Sure. Just lots of Sam Mendes.
That's who it is. You got it. Sam Mendes. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Love that. Okay. Well, in that case, then sure, you can have my $7. I appreciate that. Thanks a lot for joining us today, both of you. You're both been fantastic as always. If you want to let us know your feedback on anyone, go over to the Apple podcast app, I want to say. And
are we on Spotify? Because I get that question a lot.
We are on Spotify. And if we aren't, it's not my responsibility. It's actually Adam Boltwood, who has the only login.
Ah, yes. The technical team.
Yeah, the technical team. Adam Boltwood in his time.
The infertile Adam Boltwood.
Really need to stop making all these jokes.
I'm sorry.
It's been lovely to spend time with you guys this evening. Hopefully you've enjoyed it too. If you're not already subscribed, go subscribe. Please do leave a review, and the podcast will reach you in your sleep.
Here's what I want the listeners to do this week. Sorry to cut you off one more time. We want you to go home. Hopefully say no, don't go home, actually stay where you are, don't breathe on anyone, but tell your family members about us. If you have living family members, tell them that you listen to a football podcast and that you should also
grave and tell her about
if your gran is dead. I'm sorry, but also tell her about it if she's alive. Okay, thanks.
Excellent. Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.